Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on November 25th, 2017. This is the first in a series of talks on understanding the three marks of existence: impermanence, the not-self characteristic, and ongoing disappointment, or dukkha. It is due to misunderstanding the relationship between impermanence and wrong views of a self that dukkha arises and is maintained. There's a related article on my website, and if you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So today's talk is the first of two or three, maybe four, on the three marks of existence: anicca, anatta, and dukkha. Anicca is impermanence, anatta is the not-self characteristic, and it's because of a misunderstanding of the first two that the third arises, that dukkha arises. I'm going to read from the article and then comment a little further from that. Most of my comments are based on questions that have come up here in class and also from online students. The subtitle of this article is called Understanding the Interdependence of Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha. Interdependence, interconnectedness, and interbeing are words commonly used in modern Buddhism. Using these words to create a doctrine of universal sameness, or the interconnectedness of all phenomena, including creating a doctrine of interconnectedness or interbeing of impermanent and insubstantial ego personalities, is contrary to the Buddhist teaching. So it's a very pleasant and comforting notion that we are all one grand cosmic being. And there's some physical arguments that could be made to prove that. But it's kind of like saying oranges grow from seeds. It's true, but it doesn't really relate to the Dhamma in any useful way. The Buddha taught to see all phenomena in its discreteness and in its impermanence. And to see anything in any permanent way is to make and establish a doctrine of interconnectedness. So again, it's contrary to what the Buddha taught. Just because something is true doesn't mean it's useful Dhamma teaching. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. So maybe because we're looking, Dhamma is often interpreted as the truth. A better translation is the Buddha's truth, not just the truth in general. So things that are true are not necessarily helpful in developing the Dhamma practice. It's fun for many people to go bowling on Thursday nights. Great, you should go bowling on Thursday night. It's really not going to help your understanding of the three marks of existence by going bowling on Thursday nights. Am I making that point clear without being too silly? That type of contrary doctrines often create additional clinging to those views that have been developed. These later developed doctrines, and I don't want to sound like I'm just beating up on modern Buddhism. I'm not. I'm just pointing out the differences, and also how modern Buddhism relates to the strategies that are in place in the modern world, actually in the world since the Buddha's time, to continue ignorance of Four Noble Truths and to distract from recognizing the three marks of existence. It is deluded thinking to create a cosmic doctrine of interdependence, interconnectedness, or interbeing. This is included only for clarity, and I intend no disrespect for later developed teachings or of any individual teacher. So there's some modern teachers that really base their entire teaching on a doctrine of interbeing and on this really singular point that we're all one being. And because of that, we should practice compassion for all beings. How can you argue with that? It's true, isn't it? In one sense, we're all the same being because we're suffering from the basic same ignorance. And we should have compassion for all of the beings because of our understanding of that. But that does not develop an understanding of where suffering arises from. In fact, the act of creating an ongoing mindfulness of singular compassion without developing the wisdom of a Buddha will always contribute to your own continued delusion and suffering, and often to the delusion and suffering of others.
So when the Buddha describes himself prior to his awakening, he always used the term as an unawakened bodhisattva. What he's saying there, using those words, is that he was a human being who had great compassion for other human beings. But being unawakened, he was lacking an understanding of the underlying cause of suffering. And lacking an understanding of the underlying cause of suffering, meaning to do that, to develop the understanding, you would develop the Four Noble Truths. Lacking that understanding, you cannot effectively assist in ending your own confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering, and inadvertently possibly contributing to other suffering. So there's extreme examples of that throughout history. The Crusades are just a very good example of that. Modern jihadism is another extreme example of ideology rooted in thinking that what you're doing is right. And that's a particular truth, isn't it, in that way? Is in a way acting out of that compassion, but it's extremely hurtful to other people, isn't it? And if you think of holding on to that ideology, whether it's modern jihadism or the type of ideology that led to the Crusades, you're acting from a belief that thinks that it's a right belief. And obviously it's a belief that's rooted in ignorance of things, isn't it? So again, just to use an extreme example to make that point. Just because we believe something doesn't mean that it's true. Anicca, anatta, and dukkha are the three linked characteristics to human life. In this context, they are interconnected and interdependent. This is only to state the truth of life in the phenomenal world so that understanding of dukkha and the effect of craving and clinging can be developed. In other words, we're not creating a doctrine of establishing impermanence, wrong views resulting in a not-self characteristic and resulting dukkha. That's a doctrine of interbeing and interconnectedness, isn't it? The Buddha taught that what we are developing insight into is specifically into the impermanent nature of all things. The wrong views of self arising from ignorance, the not-self characteristic, and the resulting dukkha that comes from misunderstanding those two. So it's insight into impermanence and the not-self characteristic that develops awakening and develops a calm and peaceful mind. Not just concepts that would embrace this as a stated fact. They are stated facts, but it's not something to create a worship over. The three marks of existence of life as impermanent and impersonal is lacking a definable self. It is through the establishment of an impermanent ego self within an impermanent environment that initiates the underlying and pervasive unsatisfactory experience of life. In other words, we're trying to create a permanent self in an environment that simply can't support it. All things are impermanent, including what we would hold to be a self in any moment. And ultimately, what we gain an understanding and true insight is that it is our thoughts that are all impermanent. And once we can develop a true and profound understanding that our thoughts that we're using to define ourselves, the story we keep telling ourselves, the individual thoughts themselves are impermanent, when we profoundly understand that, our mind simply relax. We stop fighting. We stop trying to create a permanent self based on views. So, excuse me. How do wrong views manifest in our life? Outwardly by our thoughts, words, and deeds, but first, inwardly in the story we're telling ourselves. It's the ongoing conditioned thinking, the story that we have, that we're always telling ourselves, whether we're aware of it or not, that is the underlying motivation for what we're expressing in the world, that's the problem. So ultimately it comes down to the way we think, what we hold in mind. That's the essence of the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness. Mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind, and then the Buddha taught what to do with that type of mindfulness. That type of mindfulness is rooted in the concentration developed in Shamatha Vipassana meditation. The mindfulness the Buddha taught is to be mindful of each factor of the Eightfold Path as the framework for recognizing our own wrong views, and so to abandon them. You know, you've heard me say it a few times. The Buddha would often teach mindfulness this way, to be mindful of wrong view, in other words, to recognize when we're in wrong view in relation to the world, and enter and remain in right view. To be mindful when in wrong intention, meaning the intention to further the self-referential ego self through craving and clinging, and enter and remain in right intention, which is the mindful intention to hold in mind the intention in this moment to recognize eye-making and practice restraint. And he taught that that type of mindfulness in relation to all eight factors of the Eightfold Path learning.
I look upon what you've just described when your mind starts running away with the story. You either pull something out from history, from the past, and you think about that and you mull it over, or your future, or whatever. I look upon that as that's my ego re-establishing itself. So that's how I look upon it. That
yes.
That every, if I'm not in the present and my mind is just churning over and that in that just that babble, constant babble that we have in our mind, that's ego re-establishing itself in this moment.
Yes. Wow. Thank you for that. Very profound. So think about what you just said. So something comes up, something from the past, whether it was 5 minutes ago or 15 years ago, and I put myself back in that place and I start analyzing or figuring out what went wrong or who did what wrong to me or what I did to someone else. Where is that thought developed? It's developed in a delusion itself. It's not just one or two steps removed from reality, meaning where we're stuck in the past. It's infinitely stuck in delusion. And in this moment, I'm establishing myself in that deep delusion of something that happened, again, a moment ago or 15 years ago, or in my case, maybe 62 years ago in this lifetime. And it only furthers the delusion and distraction present in this moment. How could that person have stepped on my toe that way? Or I'll give an example of something that I carried with me for quite a few years. I got into an argument with a baseball umpire when I was 13 years old over a called strike. And for years, I would think about this, and this went on into my 20s. And I'd still be angry over this poor guy in a Little League baseball game that had no significance at all. But I carried it around with me. In fact, the only way I ended up working through it was he was a local eye doctor, and I went to his office one day and knocked on the door and said, "You remember what happened? I'm really sorry for acting that way." But it was the only way I could cut that conditioned response that I was carrying with me all those years, based on nothing. He had long for, in fact, he admitted, he said, I never thought twice about it, but here I was carrying it around. Just another silly example of how we do these things. Exactly.
So that's how, you know, that's how I spend my life. If I'm that's what I'm trying to correct.
Yep.
That's how I have spent my life. That's what I need to correct.
Yes.
Get into that.
That's the essence of conditioned thinking. Conditioned thinking will always lead towards distraction. And one of the strategies it does is sticking us in the past.
The future.
And then it might use that. In fact, it often uses to then project us when that's exhausted, when that strategy can no longer support itself, then the mind goes into the future. It might be concerned now about a possible similar occurrence based on what happened in the past. You know, Pavlov proved that with dogs. You know, it's conditioned thinking. That's what that means. And so we live our life never in what's occurring in this present moment, which is another way of saying an awakened, fully mature human being. That human being has developed the mental qualities to think what they want to think when they want to think it in relation to what's occurring. It's what's appropriate to what's occurring. There's no, bringing that back to what we're talking about today, there's no eye-making in this. The self that is now awakened is simply a reference point towards what's occurring. It's another way of saying it's a mind that is constantly at peace because it doesn't need anything to be different than what is occurring. It understands the nature of suffering at such a profound level that even a man-made or natural disaster that has one's attention will no longer be seen in a way that has to be different. That doesn't mean that we approve of it, of what's occurring.
Yeah, just to clarify in my mind, this isn't to say that it wouldn't be appropriate in a mindful way to regard the future in a, you know, kind of a practical way for planning or this or that, that that's not rooted in ignorance, that's not, you know, rooted in kind of a self-referential, you know, non-self I-making way, but that it's like a practical thought for the future.
Yes.
Am I wrong or right?
No, you're absolutely right. So,
because I'm like, oh, you know, we're in this world where we have to plan for our lessons, or we have to plan for our grocery shopping, we have to, you know, plan for this and not the other thing. So I find myself thinking about the next thing often, and it can be it can feel distracting, but there's some practicality to that and how to navigate that.
How to navigate it. The Buddha taught the Eightfold Path as, and he described it, as the middle way between extreme views. And it's those extreme views that drive suffering, that give rise to suffering. He described dukkha, suffering, in this way. Birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. Not getting what is desired is suffering. Receiving what is undesired is suffering. And those two is how, when we're stuck in one of those two, we know that we're stuck in eye-making. And that's the difference between planning and eye-making.
Can
so,
you say that again?
Sometimes I speak too quickly when I get excited about that.
Yeah, self, you know, getting something that you don't want or getting something,
craving for what is desired.
Yeah.
Or receiving something that is undesired, worry. And actually those are both sides of the same craving coin. Being distracted with what I want is also the same thing as being distracted by not getting what I don't want.
Right.
Still desire. When I'm distracted by what I want, it's almost always a future thought. I'm taking myself out of the moment, I'm projecting myself into a scenario or an event that may or may not occur, and I'm insisting that it be a certain way. Mm-hmm. That's the same as saying, I'm projecting myself in a future event and describing and establishing what I don't want in that moment. Mm-hmm. Do you see the eye making in that?
Yeah.
Rather than understanding that Thursday the refrigerator is going to be bare and I need to go shopping Wednesday to buy food, or Thursday. Mm-hmm. There's no eye making in that. That's just a practical way of living in the world. Another way of bringing that back to the Buddha's time, the Buddha got up off his cushion nearly every day. Once in a while someone would do this for him. But nearly every day he walked into town with the other monks and nuns with a bowl in his hand, essentially begging for food. And they filled the bowl up and they went back to wherever they were staying, and a little while later they ate their food. It wasn't eye-making walking into town, getting the bowl filled up and eating it. It was planning for the meal that they needed to sustain life. It was practical. Those that walked into town hoping that they get a nice steak with a baked potato on it were eye-making.
Right, and the suffering from that.
And the suffering when all they got was a bowl of rice with maybe a bean or two on top.
Right.
Is the dukkha that they created in their own minds through their own thinking. Through putting expectations on what was occurring. And again, often those scenarios that we create in our minds, or I probably should say nearly 100% of the time, if not 100% of the time, are rooted in past experience, meaning they're conditioned from what has occurred. Mm-hmm. So a self-referential self is always has an underlying level of fear, whether it's apparent or not. And it's that underlying fear that is really generating or motivating what's going to occur. And because there's that underlying, sometimes very, very subtle fear, it often manifests in extreme fear. What's going to happen? This could happen. The world's going to come to an end. The Chicken Little story. Mm-hmm. Rather than being present with life as life occurs. And so in this moment, because I know I have to put food in the refrigerator on Wednesday, and on Tuesday I have to go to work to make the money. That's not a projection, or it's not worry. It's just simple practical a practical way of living in the world. It's good hygiene to clean the bed sheets once, well, in my case, once every 6 years. So once in a while, I'll do a laundry. That's not, doing the laundry is not being stuck in the future, unless it's because I know people are coming over and I need to be known as the greatest laundry doer of all time. There's eye making in that, rather than just having some nice clean clothes and clean sheets. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
And so look at the eye making. Am I doing this to get what I want, or doing this to avoid what I don't want to receive, or is it simply a practical way of living in the world? The Buddha said we need four things as human beings. He didn't say we don't need anything. Mm-hmm. He said we need food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. And so the things that we, and if you think about even how the Buddha and the original Sangha lived their life, they always addressed those needs and developed the Dhamma. They made sure they had food every day. They made sure that they had clothing. Often it was clothing that they made together out of rags that they gathered, but they all had clothing. They took an effort in that. They made sure that they had proper shelter that night. Sometimes it might have been just laying some twigs on the ground, but they prepared it. And when they were sick, they knew how to get some proper medicine, which was usually, you know, herbs and that type of thing, but sometimes it was food. They had an understanding even back then of how these types of things could affect you. But they put a mindful effort into doing these things, into establishing themselves that way. So it's such an important question, because it could, the when you first hear of this, or even as you're developing it, it can lead to, well, what does it mean? I don't do anything? Mm-hmm. In fact, what it means is we ultimately get to the point where we're only doing the things that are mindfully useful. And we've really discarded all the rest because we've abandoned the eye-making. Mm-hmm. So a very profound question. Thank you. This is going to be a 3 or 4 part talk. But it, I mean, this is why we do this.
Well, it is the three marks of existence.
Yeah.
Each mark.
Yeah. The Eightfold Path directly develops the understanding of eye making within an impermanent environment and the subsequent unsatisfactory experience of the ego self. So that's the other thing that Anatta gets caught up with, is always being satisfied, always getting what it wants, and always striving for the things that it thinks to maintain that happiness. And some people it's power, sometimes it's, and some people it's the acquisition of, you know, the finest things. Some people it's a, you know, a huge number of friends. It might be the, you know, the right club or anything. We have all kinds of strategies of continuing to establish itself based on what it thinks it needs to be happy. That's all eye making. Because of the impermanent nature of all things, anything we use to establish a permanent self and create an identity of it, of that self, is inherently unsatisfactory and so prone to suffering to that ego self. Is that clear? Okay. The sole purpose of the Dhamma is to recognize and abandon craving and all clinging views of an ego self. Craving and clinging causes a confusion and distraction of dukkha, of suffering. Abandoning craving and clinging brings an end to dukkha. That's the whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma, to recognize craving and clinging and abandon it. That's right intention. And right intention directly leads to the moral or virtual factors of the Eightfold Path of right speech, right action, and right livelihood, because it's in being mindful of those that we're able to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. It establishes itself in thoughts, words, and deeds. A more clear way of saying it is anatta, the not self-characteristic, establishes itself in thoughts, words, and deeds, and then attaches itself to those things. How many times do we say something that we know isn't really quite right, but because somebody else has thrown that back in our face, we insist that it's right? That's eye-making. Holding on to views. Engaging in endless argument. You know, most of us are probably beyond that, but that's kind of a common occurrence, isn't it? Defending our views, getting in arguments about that, or getting into wars to defend views. Or again, practical examples of that is gang violence. They're doing those kind of things to extend their views. I'm using another extreme example, but it's modern and understandable, isn't it? That's why gangs do the things they do, because they're trying to promote their view of what they think they need to exist in the world. You know, get away from all the sociological underpinnings of why they do it. But that's what happens, isn't it? But we all do that. We all do it to some extent. We create a view, and then we spend the rest of our lives establishing and maintaining that view that creates suffering for ourselves and often for others. The Buddha's words, free of craving and clinging, one is not agitated. Think about that. It's the teachings of an awakened human being. Free of craving and clinging, one is not agitated. If we would really get that and could just see it and penetrate that to its most profound level, the Buddha wouldn't have had to say another word, would he?
Mm-hmm. I think I like the reverse of that too, is that if you're agitated, you are craving and clinging, because a lot of times you don't see it.
Yeah.
Yes, and that's when you know you're stuck in eye-making, you're stuck in craving and clinging. Thank you. When agitated, you are craving and clinging. The Buddha And why do we accept things as they are? Because they are. Not because they're right or wrong. Not because I approve of it or disapprove. Because it's what has occurred.
The kitchen is just a mess.
Yeah.
This is what's happening.
And without the judgment that I'm so lazy, and that's why the kitchen is just a mess. And that allows the mind to maybe go to, I have a few minutes. You know, let me clean a pot or a pan. Unfortunately, my thinking never goes. The Buddha continues. I don't live. I wash my dishes. And but there are times. The Buddha continues the next sentence. Unagitated, this one is totally unbound and free of dukkha. An arahant, an awakened human being. In those two sentences, the Buddha describes it all, doesn't he? And when he describes an awakened human being, he describes that human being as a mind that is released from clinging or unbound from clinging. Both of these sentences point to the overarching theme of impermanence. We can go from an agitated mind to an unagitated mind. We can go from craving and clinging to being free or unbound from craving and clinging, due to the impermanent nature of all things. If self-referential ego self, if anatta was truly successful in establishing a permanent self, a Buddha never would have been able to figure it out in the first place. Delusion would be the common experience of human beings. So that's not the right way. Delusion would be the permanent experience of human beings. Once deluded, there'd be no way of getting out of it because of permanence. So the Four Noble Truths, in a general way, all point to impermanence. And the Third Noble Truth defines that permanence. Cessation of dukkha is possible. And then the next Noble Truth is that the truth leading to the cessation of dukkha is the path developing, meaning the Eightfold Path. As concentration increases through shamatha vipassana meditation, the process of establishing and maintaining an ego self is able to be mindfully observed. That's the whole point of concentration in the Eightfold Path, to recognize in the moment how I'm establishing or trying to establish an ego self. How in this moment I'm continuing eye-making, how in this moment I'm stuck in conceit, for the sole reason of recognizing it and abandoning it. Again, another way of saying that is practicing restraint as we recognize eye-making coming up. As we recognize that our minds are agitated, practice restraint in this moment. Once this process is recognized with right intention and the other mutually supportive factors of the Eightfold Path, the continued establishment and defense of an ego self is finally abandoned. It's through that whole process. Impermanent stress and the ego self are all observable facts of human existence. What the Buddha discovered upon his awakening with a quiet and well-concentrated mind is that all things are conditioned particles of energy that have coalesced into the appearance of form. And I won't get it too deeply into this. But the Buddha described something back then that our modern physicists and scientists are just coming to grasp with, and that is and I don't even know the right word anymore, but the super subatomic particles that they're able to separate from other matter and observe in certain ways. The Buddha describes something called kalapas, K-L-A-P-A-S, as infinitely small particles of energy that millions of them blink into existence and blink out of existence in the blink of an eye, as the underlying energy of all things. Now, he never got into developing a doctrine of this in any way, except simply to point out that there is an underlying energetic experience in all matter. And now there's, you know, the wave and the particle thing, is I'm not going to get into that either. In all things of impermanence. And we are now just starting to get a deep understanding of something that the Buddha recognized that many years ago. The Buddha continues, out of the formless state, we now have form. The seemingly separate forms that we perceive are impermanent and absent of any self-inherent nature, including the form we perceive as I. My words. It requires continued ever-vigilant directed thought to maintain the ego self in an impermanent environment. Another way of saying this is clinging to form. This is stress, this is dukkha. Because of the underlying impermanent nature of all things, and now that kalapas and the subatomic particles all describe a process that we're all going through in this moment. In the blink of an eye, millions of what makes us up are coming into existence and going out of existence. So trying to describe a permanent self even with that understanding is foolish, isn't it? And the only way we can get to then, yeah, but, is to start using our own thoughts as self-reference. Well, yeah, but, I'm the same person now as I was when I walked in here. I'm the same person as I was 15 years ago. But we're not, are we? Everything has changed, including at a cellular level. And we know that every cell in our body regenerates itself completely after around 7 years. But that's not even all that useful a thought to recognize that in this moment, everything is impermanent. And the power that comes from recognizing that, accepting that, and developing that, is that my thoughts are impermanent too. And so I can make my thoughts whatever I want, especially the thoughts about myself, can't I? And if I have the right frame of reference, I can develop the ability to think what I want to think when I want to think it, rather than thoughts that are driven from conditioned thinking. Conditioned thinking rooted in ignorance. I can now have an ongoing way of looking at the world that is rooted in wisdom, meaning an understanding of the way things truly are. That's the most profound and useful teachings of impermanence. Excuse me. And it's the most useful teachings. The most useful teachings on developing an understanding of the not-self characteristics. There's just one more point I want to get to, and then we'll continue this next week. This confused and conditioned thinking can be refined and purified and bring relief from craving and clinging. Prior to his awakening, the future Buddha wandered northern India with 5 colleagues, still seeking understanding. Kandana was one of the Buddha's 5 colleagues. A few weeks after his awakening, the Buddha presented the 4 Noble Truths to Kandana and the other 4 seekers. I know you've heard me say this over and over again, but it's such an important point, and even more important in this context of this series of talks. Upon hearing this first discourse of the Buddha, Kandana declared, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. All conditioned things that are subject to arise are subject to cessation. Condition, in a broad sense, means something that arises in dependence of something else. In a direct way, it's conditioned thoughts that are dependent on ignorance that give rise to suffering, dependent origination. All conditioned things, all suffering that arises, is subject to cessation. At a very profound level, the Kandana is saying that dukkha itself is conditioned and subject to arising and passing away. My own thoughts are subject to arising and passing away. There's a correlation between those two. That's a profound understanding of the not-self characteristic, creating a self out of wrong views, and trying to establish that self in an environment that we hope is permanent, but is in truth impermanent. Those first 2 marks of existence. By that misunderstanding, by trying to establish a permanent self in an environment that cannot support it, we create suffering in our lives. That process is rooted in deluded thinking. That process is understood through a meditation practice that deepens concentration so that we can integrate the entire Eightfold Path as the framework for recognizing the three marks of existence. So when the Buddha teaches insight, he didn't teach insight in a general way, although that is what develops. If we're trying to gain insight into a general way, into everything that's occurring, then everything becomes a distraction, which is there's a modern Buddhist practice that is almost designed that way. The Buddha taught the Eightfold Path to gain insight into these three marks of existence. And it is through developing insight into these three marks of existence that Khandana awakened. That's what he's speaking to. All conditioned things. Another way of saying that is conditioned things are impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas that through craving and clinging we try to make permanent. And Khandana said, wait a minute. Even those conditioned things are subject to cessation. All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. That's the end of today's talk. We'll see. This might be a six-part of it. Great questions and great discussions. Any other questions about the talk? And then we'll just go around. Okay, Anthony, good to see you this morning.
Good morning.
I think meditation has really helped me to see how random and uncontrollable thoughts can be.
Yes.
And I also think it's like we have these neurons flashing in our brain, because when you're meditating, you're trying to not think. Well, you're not trying not to think, but you're just focusing on the breath, and then a thought pops in, and then you let that go and go back to the breath, and you realize that you really don't have a lot of control over the thoughts.
Yeah.
Except they kind of come in like waves, and if you decide to ride one, that's when the craving and clinging starts.
Yeah.
And if you can't get off the surfboard, that's when the fear, panic, and anxiety start.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot to that, but I think to the extent you can, there is no randomness to it. I think that when we're younger, we're thinking a lot more about the future. When we're older, we're thinking a lot more about the past.
Yeah.
I sort of notice that pattern as I get older.
Yeah.
But sometimes, because when you meditate, you're creating a spaciousness in your mind, and I think sometimes it inspires some really great insights.
Yep.
And creative thoughts. So I try to keep a pad by my cushion, and if something comes up that I just know I'm not going to remember at any point, I'll take a break and write it down.
Yeah.
Because it usually relates to a case, and it usually is something that I wouldn't have thought of if it wasn't meditating, because I'd be so distracted with what's going on. So I try to do that very judiciously. Like maybe I've done it 5 times in the last 3 years, but there are times I know that something comes in your head that is just too good to not stop the meditation.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Anyway, those are my thoughts on thoughts.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I think that's a very useful and effective way to deal with those insights to come up during meditation. So it's often off our cushions that impermanence within the framework of the Eightfold Path occurs, that we recognize it. But that's not to say that during meditation we won't gain insight into things. And when it's a practical way and you don't want to forget it, I think that's a great idea. Just jot it down. Come back to your meditation.
Yeah, and then the funny thing is if you don't do it, then it just disturbs the rest of your meditation. So
try to remember.
Because I feel like I have to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that. It's very useful. And the idea of using your meditation in that simple way that you described it is so important. That when you're caught up in a story, come back to the sensation of breathing. That's the essence of it. And then off our cushions, that meditation, that concentration that we're able to develop that way and only that way, we're able to use off our cushions to integrate the Eightfold Path.
I read an article. Is that a website called Tricycle?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I read an article in Tricycle, and it was a lawyer, actually, and he has a pre-meditation before the meditation just so he can do that, like just, you know, to inspire stuff on his work, and then he meditates.
Yeah. Wow.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is. Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you.
Becky, good to see you.
I'm very good to be here. This was really interesting to me to listen to this talk, because since I kind of got away from meditation in the last few months due to, you know, traveling, you know, whatever the reason. And since I've come back and now things have calmed down a little bit, I've been meditating again in the last, like, couple of weeks a little more regularly. And I've realized that what happens to me when I got away from it was that my mind uses the things I have to do all the time, the things that you have to do that are your life as a distraction.
Yep.
My mind becomes totally focused on those things, and they become, you know, they're all distractions. They're all distractions. They're all eye making.
Yeah.
They're all those things. But of course, you don't realize that when it's happening. And then, all of a sudden, I sit down to meditate, or I get back into the practice, and I realize that everything is just tight. And at the very center of that tightness is this fear that you talked about.
Yeah.
It's this fear. And then all of that stuff that I'm thinking of, that I have to do, that I have to plan for, is to distract me from that fear. In some way, it's like,
yeah.
Well, if I keep thinking I have to do that, then I won't be afraid. I won't be thinking about the horrible things that could happen in the future.
Yeah.
And when you realize, every once in a while, when I'm meditating or when I'm here, I will get just a glimpse of what it would be like to just let that go. Just a slight glimpse will come in for a minute or for just a moment, and you're like, you just like want to grab onto that, but you can't. You know, you realize that you just have to keep practicing, because that's what's going to make you be able to just let go of all of this eye making and fear about things changing. And it is harder when you get older, because, you know, big changes are going to be coming, and you just have to. It's so helpful to notice.
Yeah.
And I have noticed too in my everyday life, when I, even when I'm not practicing, that sometimes when I get, you know, just really, that I can get out of like a, I can calm myself down a little bit by just thinking about this and
yeah.
about what I've learned and about how to use it. So that's all I have to say.
That's a lot. Thank you, Becky. That those glimpses are, that's useful insight into.
Oh.
I mean, that's really the point. And that the distraction that you described is how anatta, a self-referential ego self, maintains itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's through that constant distraction and that underlying fear that's there. That it won't be able at some point, there won't be a moment that it can't establish itself in. And that distraction is the useful strategy to continue to ignore ignorance that anatta uses. In fact, it requires distraction in order to maintain that ignorance. Yeah, I think you've heard me say a few times that the Buddha could have nearly as accurately described the First Noble Truth as there is distraction as there is dukkha. Because it's the preoccupation with dukkha that the not-self characteristic is able to maintain itself. But remember, that self that it's maintaining is like foam on the water. There's nothing there. We're not letting go of anything that's of any value or usefulness to an awake and fully mature human being.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank
Jen, good to see you.
Hi, good to see you. I like the teachings on the three marks of existence. Because, I feel like everything is at the heart of the matter, but I just feel like this one is, for me, it just kind of, that's like the beginning of the practice.
Yeah.
So, like, when you need to come back to the beginning, I can't remember, I think I was talking about last week, just coming back to the beginning is recognizing impermanence, and then also just the knowing that the human mind works this way in everyone to to maintain this, which, I mean, I don't want to get too analytical, but on a very embryonic level, early life level may have some benefit, but childhood and adolescence, you know, that kind of, I need to make sure I'm okay. Nature of mind, aspect of mind can be let go of, because now the body can do what it needs to do without our input.
Yeah.
But it is, it feels permanent all the time. It always feels permanent, and you always have to keep your mind on the idea that it's not permanent in order to, like, stay present.
Oh, you have to, yeah.
It's like, it's the thing that the Buddha says in the end of his life, it just always comes to my mind, like, it's something's relentless, you know, work diligently for your own salvation. It's like
decay
all,
is
every
relentless.
Day, all the time, every moment.
Yeah. It's the most important thing. It doesn't mean the only thing, but it's the most important thing.
Right.
Thank you for that. It's understanding impermanence in that way can really help direct our practice when you realize it. Like the mindfulness of Bahia Sutta, the Bahia Sutta. You know? Bahia begged the Buddha to teach me the Dhamma concisely, because at any moment this could all be over. I could be dead, you could be dead. And the Buddha finally taught him the Dhamma in a very concise way, but he awakened, and the next moment he was trampled by a cow. Everybody laughs, I said. He was right, wasn't he? You know, he was right. But he in that brief period of time, he heard the Dhamma and he awakened.
I think the reason I'm not awakening is just because I'm afraid of getting troubled by a cow.
It still could happen. You better get to it.
Don't hang out in those cow fields. Don't toss and kill
patties. Thank you. I'll leave it at that. Laura, good to see you this morning.
It's really great to be here, and I'm very grateful for the Sangha group and for you.
Thank you.
And for the teachings that can be taught. So it's really nice. I feel like I'm, this is a, you know, like a big dose of multivitamin for my practice today.
Good.
And so that it's such, the three marks of existence, it's like, it's so simple that every moment we complicate that, the fact of these things. So it's just a really good reminder to bring it all back to letting go of our attachments and our, you know, the ego that we want to build up, our not-self that we want to build up in our various interactions during the day, or plannings that we have to make, and putting ourselves there and imagining what it's going to be like, because this is, we're so conditioned to do that. That's the way that's the way the world is around us. And I'm grateful for the insight of impermanence and having had the experience of how that insight looks and feels and this sense of freedom from clinging and craving that comes when there's a period of resting in that kind of mindful state where you're on the path and it's all there in front of you and you know, no matter how many dishes there are to do or how much there is to do around you, everything can come and take its course without feeling burdened by too many tasks. And I've been thinking about that a little bit, just this idea of not burdening yourself with too much work so that it feels like you are unable to do your practice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I know that we have the ability to burden ourselves with so much and make so many excuses, but I'm kind of just trying to pay attention to like actual practical things that I may be doing to put on my plate that's burdening myself from not being able to do my practice, and that what I can see is that when I take on too much, it's because I'm stuck in eye making.
Yeah.
So like I'm stuck in some story, and that's why all of a sudden the plate is too full. So that it all kind of comes back to the truth of these teachings. So it's a wonderful thing, the Eightfold Path, and I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
I'm glad you're here. Thank you for that. A constantly full plate is the most successful strategy to justify not developing the Dhamma, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just too busy. And if you think about that, the full plate, there is a lot of eye making in that. The world, you know, this can't get done without me, that can't get done without me, I have to do this because there's always time to cut just a little bit out. And again, the most loving thing we can do, the most important thing we can do for ourselves and all others is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. But it is the common problem. The reason why the Buddha and the initial Sangha went and lived in the forest, wherever they lived, I mean, they traveled around a lot, wasn't because there was something inherently wonderful about living in the forest. It was an acknowledgement of being entangled in the world does not lead to developing the Dhamma as effectively as it could be. That's not to say that you can't either. But there, it is difficult being entangled in the world. And we have, part of right effort is to recognize when we're putting too much on our plate and leave a little bit off, you know. So thank you. It's such a profound thing to recognize. And recognizing that how complicated we make the three marks of existence when they're not. They're obvious facts of life. But because of the need to ignore our own ignorance, we create these strategies that ignore the impermanence of all things and create a permanence in things where there's nothing permanent. But continuity obscures impermanence, doesn't it? The continuity of even a full plate day after day after day. You know? It can get us to the thinking, well, at some point, you know, maybe next Wednesday I can meditate. I can read a little bit. You know, we're all giggling because we've all done that, haven't we?
Mm-hmm.
We've all had that thought. Today is not a good day. Tomorrow will be a good day. What's that thing? Tomorrow never comes, Jen.
I had this, so in the Karaniya Metta Sutta where the Buddha says, unburdened by duties and frugal in their ways.
Yeah.
For a long time I heard that as unburdened by duties, meaning I don't have a lot of duties.
Oh.
I don't have a lot of things to do. So I'm therefore being really good at managing my life and like not taking on too much. But then I heard it differently as I have a lot of duties, but I'm not burdened by them, which is the other way of thinking about it, to
mm-hmm.
say,
yeah.
I have a lot to do, but I am capable of prioritizing
yeah.
practice,
yeah.
even though holy cow, that feels like a lot of stuff that I have to do. How am I going to possibly, it's just going to happen. I'm just going to, it's not easy to do. Just another way of looking at it.
It's a great one. Thank you for that. The Buddha often talked about this ongoing process, the necessary to maintain a self, ongoing process of the burden of eye-making. And so the Buddha speaking directly to that in the Metta Sutta too. Unburdened with duties, unburdened with the duties of having a self attached to the things that we normally have to do. And frugal in their ways. Meaning frugality is something that we do intentionally. It's not something that just happens. So we're frugal. We're practicing restraint in establishing a self in each of these moments, in the things that we have to do. So it's a very insightful way of seeing it. It'll have more meaning when I read it in just a few minutes. So thank you. Mary, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to be here. I mean, this teaching is so sort of, in some ways, brief and elegant, but when you look more into it, it's not at all brief, but it's so elegant.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, putting too much on your plate is so easy to do to feed your ego.
Yeah.
Realizing that, in reality, that whatever needs to be done will get done, and you don't have to do anything. Or you don't have to do everything, rather. But,
yeah.
You know, I'm dealing with somebody right now who's just tried to put too much on her plate, and she can't let it go. And I feel sorry for her, but at the same time, I'm involved in a tour that has to take place, and she kind of gets in her own way. And you know, it's all about feeding the ego, and I just have to let it, I let it go. I have to let it go at this point in my life, because feeding your ego doesn't get you anywhere. It's taken me a long time to realize that, and by taking these classes, it certainly has driven the point home that it's a lot more effective to check your ego at the door and to realize that nothing is burning.
And that makes not feeding the ego much easier, isn't it? When
oh, yeah,
you recognize the impermanence
yeah.
of all things.
Yeah.
Again, that's what Kundana awakened for. Thank you for saying that. A well-fed ego just gets a fat ego.
Yeah.
You know? And
it gives everyone around you a headache.
What's that?
It gives everyone around you a headache.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, again, the practical aspect of practicing restraint keeps a nice thin ego.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mary. Kevin, good to see you this morning. And I want to thank you and your wife again, Robin, for putting some decent frames on those things up there.
Yeah, it's all Robin.
Yeah.
Oh,
it was,
nice.
No, it wasn't all Robin. It was your initial generosity that began it. So thank you. It is remarkable.
Feeling, that's how I felt about this too. I think since we're all human beings, we've all felt this. And when we met this teaching, we had this challenge, and we're constantly facing the challenge. And I think successfully, you can hear it the way people express it. So thank you for that teaching. Fortunately, we have the three jewels to be able to counteract these three marks, the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha. And we have our teacher, the fourth jewel.
I think I've ever been described that.
The jewel.
Thank you, Kevin. I do appreciate that. To me, the most remarkable thing in my life is discovering these teachings of an awakened human being from 2,600 years ago, and that they're still effective, and that I have a mind that can understand it. Not that I have a special type of mind, I have an ordinary human mind, but that mind, that ordinary human mind, is able to develop an awakened human being's teachings. It's remarkable. We're all so fortunate. And to have what we have, what has developed here, a well-focused Sangha, meaning people that are actually interested in this, because it is rare. in the middle of writing and just about done writing this famous sutta called the Anapanasati Sutta, the sutta on being mindful of the breath. And in that line, the Buddha talks about the rarity of a well-focused sangha. And as I'm writing it, I'm thinking about all of you and how rare this really is. And even with a Buddha alive in the world, a well-focused sangha was something that was rare. But
it's unfortunate that in the news that they just focus on the most unconscious people who commit horrendous acts of violence,
yeah,
when they should be focusing on people awakening in places like this.
Like
unless somebody came in here branding a gun, we wouldn't be on the news.
Yeah, and it would be an afterthought. So you think about
it's
why does that appeal? Why does the violence appeal so much that it drives ratings? Because
fear.
That's what
it instills fear in people.
Well, but that's what in a general way a deluded ego self attaches itself to. It's a great distraction to hear those things. I sent our president a copy of the book. I haven't heard back from him yet, but you never know. I did.
I don't know if he can read it yet.
You never know. I also sent one to Oprah and a few other folks, so we'll see what happens.
Oprah may read it.
I did it with all sincerity, hoping that maybe it'll make a difference. Who knows? You never know. The point of it really is, though, that each and every one of us has the responsibility to awaken. If we're really concerned, if we're great bodhisattvas, we'll take it the next step that the Buddha did and actually awaken, because then we have the possibility of actually doing some good in the world. And we're all doing that. You know, we're here on a Saturday morning following that same path. So, Lorna, good to see you. Good morning.
Good to be here. See everybody and hear such wonderful comments. Really,
yeah.
Along with you being the fourth jewel, I thought that was a gem.
Yes, that is great.
Thank you.
You are now the fourth jewel.
You have been.
You're going to have to come up
you
with a whole...
And the eighth wonder of the world.
Yeah, a whole new sutta there, you know. The Ratana plus
sutta.
One sutta.
Thinking that I'm really getting the benefit of that. So I'm doing half an hour in the morning, half an hour in the evening. But also, as I said earlier in the class, that doing your meditation, realizing you're caught up in your thoughts, come back to your breath, which is what we do in meditation, you can do as much work again off your cushion. You know,
yeah.
When you're caught up in your thoughts, realize your eye making, realize it's your ego that's trying to establish itself in the moment, whether you're washing dishes or, you know, driving the car or whatever you're doing. That's your ego trying to establish itself. And just seeing that and understanding it, acknowledging that, and then coming back to your breath, helps you see that it's I've lost the train of diminish the importance of your own thoughts when you realize it's your ego. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It helps you diminish it. That's what I've been doing this week is sort of on the cushion, you know, really getting down to some meditation and hanging on in there for half an hour, comfortable or not, doing the half an hour meditation, and then throughout the day, noticing thoughts, how ego-driven they are. That's what it is. That's all it is. Come back to the breath.
Yeah.
And when you do that, it all just fades away anyway. It kind of just, and then even 15 seconds later, you can't remember what you're thinking about, but you're so caught up in it. And just seeing that pattern over and over and over and over and over and over again.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that. Recognizing the impersonal nature of our thoughts, you know, the things that we used to take so personal, so attached to our thoughts, or using our thoughts to define us, and finally recognizing it is, again, it's the essence of awakening. You've been coming to class about 2.5 years, am I right? And now you're meditating for 30 minutes twice a day. The importance of that, and excuse me for using you as a, you know, whatever. You developed a 30-minute twice-a-day meditation gradually, the most effective way, rather than starting out. Now, if I told you 2.5 years ago that you have to meditate for 30 minutes twice a day or you have no practice, you never would have came back to another class, probably. Or you might have come 2 or 3 times and then blame yourself because you just can't do it. And again, there's nothing in the suttas that the Buddha put a time limit on any meditation. And beginning with short periods of meditation and gradually increasing the length of meditation as you're increasing your understanding of the entire Eightfold Path is the way to establish a Dhamma practice. It's exactly how the Buddha taught it. And your insight into what we're talking about now, the three marks of existence, has developed along with lengthening your meditation. And the important point of that, and again, excuse me for using you as the object of this, but it makes a good point. The important point of that is it's you didn't have to develop 30-minute meditation twice a day to develop insight into the three marks of existence. It developed together as part of one complete practice, integrating the Eightfold Path. And so you're a great example of how important that is. We all are, but that just makes the point. It's not just meditation. It's not length of meditation. There's meditation. Often meditation is taught within most of the, if it's even taught at all, it's taught, well, you got to start with 45 minutes or you have to start with an hour. And there's usually no real context, meaning no Eightfold Path taught to support that meditation practice. And that's why so many people fail at meditation, because it's taught incorrectly. It's taught in an unrealistic way. But this way is a realistic, in any way, anybody can meditate for a couple of minutes. And over time, within the right framework, we can develop a deeper understanding of why we're meditating, and that supports the meditation practice. And as we start gaining glimpses or insight into the three marks of existence, that reinforces our meditation practice. So eventually, 2.5 years later, 5 years later, a year later, we're meditating more comfortably and for longer periods of time, but none of it is forced. There's no grasping in it.
Mm-hmm.
No, okay, so that's enough for today. We'll finish with the Metta Sutta, but next week we'll start getting into Anatta, and we'll see where this series of talks goes. It might be 3 weeks at least, but they're always good. And you see that we... on Saturday, we finished up with the awakening to the Four Noble Truths, and that naturally led into this. What are we doing with the Eightfold Path now? Gaining this understanding. So. All right, so find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.